Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Melissa, and I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I want to say, Travis, you did an amazing job. Everybody, please. I aspire to be as funny and as eloquent as Travis was. Congratulations to Antonio for 2 years. That's huge. To the 90-day token takers, Brandy, Leo, and Mike, I believe. 90 days is huge. Like 90 days without a drink. My God, when I got here, it was like, why would anyone do that? Why would you want to do that, you know? But I was here. My sobriety date is December 23, 2009. So I've got close to 8.5 years now. And, you know, for anybody who's miserable, for anybody who thinks this sucks, all I can say is it gets better. It gets so much better. Like, just, you know, not a straight uphill climb, you know, it kind of has its little dips and valleys, but it's just amazing. My life today is, I mean, first of all, I am 180 degrees different person than I was when I walked in here. I know myself. I know what I like to do. I know what I don't like to do. I know, you know, I just know things about myself. I think when I got here, you know, I didn't know what colors I liked. I didn't know what seasons I liked. I didn't know, you know, seasons passed, and I didn't even see them go by. It was just, you know, it was a sad, colorless life at the end there. In the beginning, it was awesome, you know, but at the end there, it was just not awesome. You know, kind of, I think that, kind of like what Travis said, I think that I was an alcoholic from the very beginning because, I mean, from the very time I got drunk, it was I drank like an alcoholic. I was about 13 years old, and I was at a wedding with my friend, at her mom's friend's wedding, and we were outside, and my friend brought out a bottle of, like half a bottle of champagne. And I don't know that the thought had ever crossed my mind to have a drink before, but out she came with this bottle of champagne, and she was like, here, let's drink this. I'm like, sure. And we drank that, and oh, my God, it was just, I loved it. I loved everything about it. And she said, come on, let's go back into the wedding. I said, oh, no, 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 let's get more of that. Let's get more booze. And we did, and we got some red wine. And so you guys can only imagine how well the red wine and the champagne went together. Oh, it was terrible. Yeah. I threw up. I threw up in their car. It was horrible. You know, I blacked out, and but I woke up the next morning, and, you know, like so many people say, my next thought was, when can we do this again? That was awesome. And, you know, I smoked a bunch of weed. I mean, I think that for most of us, I think that for a lot of people in this room, you know, a high percentage of us, drugs are part of our story, and drugs are totally part of my story. So, you know, not to offend anyone, but I'm not going to call them outside issues because to me, I go, I know what an outside issue is, or I think what you're talking about is drugs. So that first drink was at 13 or 14, but for a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old, alcohol is not so easy to get a hold of, whereas, you know, I could get a hold of weed. I think I discovered that my dad was smoking weed when I was about 14 years old. And, you know, but things seemed all right for him. He had his own business. He was an attorney. He could smoke and drink. And I thought, well, must not be that bad. Must be all right. And I remember the first time that I got stoned when I was like 16, and I remember I was in a car, I was driving, and the car headlight, the lights in the car behind in front of me, the taillights bounced, and I saw them like tracers, you know, kind of like LSD does, and it was like, yes, like I just knew that for some reason that was my instant when I knew I was home. I knew that was it. And so from there on out, that's, you know, that's how I drank. I always drank alcoholically. And as a teenager, I had many of the experiences that people have that, you know, maybe should indicate that there's a problem. I got arrested when I was 18. I got charged with assault on an officer, resisting arrest, and drunk in public. Yeah, it's a pretty good story. I was with friends, and we were camping at, what's it called? Idyllwild? It's close by. And we were camping, and there were some people in the campsite next to us who were drinking and driving their cars around, and so the cops got called, and we were all there with a keg. And most of us were underage. Some of us were 21. I wasn't. I was 18. And the cops came, and they just basically, like, emptied the whole place out. And I was like, this sucks. I was like, you know, I thought this isn't fair, right? So here I was, and the cops were in their car already. But I was like, you know what? They were jerks. So I'm going to get their names and their badge numbers, and I'm going to write a letter of complaint. That was my idea. So I went up to the window, and I knocked on the window of the car, and the cop rolled down his window, and he was like, what do you want, little girl? And I was like, I want to get your name and your badge number, because I'm going to write a letter of complaint to the, you know, to your boss. And he said, little girl, why don't you just go home? And I was like, no, this is my constitutional right. This is what I'm going to do. So he gets out of the car, and he stands up, you know, this close to my nose, and he says, all right, can you read? And I said, yeah, you know, and I wrote down the number, and then I reached up to touch the badge number, and it was just like, for to touch his name, and I was down, and that was it. I was over. I was on the front of his car. I was handcuffed. Then I was in the back of the car, and that was it. And he took me down to the station, and he says, do you want to make a phone call? And I said, yeah, I'm going to call my lawyer. And he said, your lawyer, don't you want to call your parents? I said, yeah, I'm going to call my dad. He's a lawyer. You know, like. So, you know, that went over really well. So he dialed the number for me. He gave it to me. And I said, you know, Dad, I'm in jail. And he says, is the cop there? I said, yeah. He says, let me talk to him. So I said, my dad wants to talk to you. And the cop was like, this is how I remember it. He took the phone. He put my dad on hold. He called up Riverside County Jail. And he's like, yeah, we're bringing her over. And so that's how I remember it. And that's exactly what happened. He got back on the phone with my dad. He said, you can pick up your daughter at Riverside County Jail in about 6 hours. And they shackled me, my, you know, all the way around and transferred me to Riverside County Jail. But, and, you know, I got sentenced to AA, and I came here a couple of times, and I was like, no. I was like, what? No, no, no. I just like to party. I don't have a problem. This is just a bump in the road. This is nothing wrong here. And I got a big book. They gave me a big book. And the funny thing is that big book sat in my room until I went off to college, you know, for the next few years. And I just would look at it like, I don't, what is that? You know, like, I didn't know. It just sat there. Little did I know that later it would become my favorite book. After that, I mean, you know, I had all the things that happened to women happen as an alcoholic teenager. You know, I got hurt. I got, you know, pushed around. You know, I got put myself in situations that I never should have been in. You know, I came out without a scrape for the most part. Some memories, but nothing that I haven't been able to work through. You know, how I never got a DUI, I have no idea, because I can't tell you how many times I drove my friends home like this, one hand over my eye. You know, but I still didn't, I certainly didn't sense anything was wrong. Even though, you know, and looking back, yeah, I came from an alcoholic family because, like I said, my dad was drinking and smoking all throughout my childhood. And I guess, you know, people talk about their childhoods and what was traumatic for them. I didn't have any overt trauma. Nobody hurt me as a kid physically, but my dad was so busy getting high, something that I would never understand until I figured out I was an addict myself, but he was so busy getting high himself that he was not around for me. And what that looked like to me was that he didn't love me. I didn't know that he was just an alcoholic and an addict who needed to, that was how he coped with life and that was what he was doing, that it wasn't personal whatsoever and that he loved the heck out of me. That's what it was like growing up. But my mom, you know, my mom covered all that up and my mom made up for it 10 times. She cared for us and she, you know, she never made it. You know, we had everything we needed. I had more than I needed. I mean, come on. I grew up in Irvine, California. I had everything I needed and more. But I still felt that, you know, I always had that not enough feeling. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not lovable. I had all that stuff. And when I took... It wasn't that first time I drank. I don't think that that feeling went away. But it was when I turned 16 and I started, you know, drinking and using on a regular basis that I realized, like, you know, then I just didn't care anymore. Like, at least I thought, I didn't care what you guys thought. You know, it didn't hurt anymore. It was just, you know, I could go. I loved going to parties on the weekends. You know, we would do our caravans from this keg party to that keg party and you know, do whatever we could in between, and it was a great time. I thought it was a great time. I mean, it was a great time, come on. And, you know, like I said, I didn't face any consequences for a long time. You know, I tell you all this stuff just to identify. I mean, that's what it was like for me. I drank because I didn't know it either. My mom told me. My mom was so smart, and I did. She said, "You're just doing this to numb your feelings." No. I'm doing this because it's fun and because I like to party and I like, you know, I'm having a good time. And she's like, "No, you're doing this to numb your feelings." Well, little did I know. I mean, she's married to my dad. She's watching my dad do the exact same thing, you know. But I don't know why she thought that. You know, who knows? I don't know. But, you know, I did it all through high school, and hey, I graduated. I graduated with a B. I didn't have to work too hard to graduate. I was on track to go to college. Like, it was just from the time I was a kid, it was pretty much fed to me, you're going to college. And you know, I didn't try, it doesn't matter. I didn't try to get into a four-year school. I just knew I was going to go to a junior college and do it that way. So that's what I did. I went to junior college, and I just continued partying and having a good time. And then when it was time to go to a four-year school, I picked Humboldt State University because, come on, right? It was perfect. It was in the early 90s when, you know, we just became chronic. It was like... Oh, my God, it was a great time to be in Humboldt County, I'll tell you right now. And I loved it. Jerry Garcia was still alive, at least for the first 2 years. I saw the dead many times. It was awesome. And, like, it was this little teeny tiny town. And seriously, and you can still smoke in bars, and I smoked. So, like, I could just stay in a bar, even by myself. I felt comfortable because it was this little tiny town. I felt comfortable. I could be in the bar by myself, drinking and smoking, and then walk home, and I just felt safe, you know. I could be hammered, and I just felt safe. So I did that for a few years, you know, and everything seemed to be going along just fine. I was studying environmental science. I was pretty sure I knew what I wanted to do. And, you know, everything was kind of on track. My dad was paying for everything. You know, it was cheap enough to go to school there, kind of. At the time, it was like, you know, like $1,200 a semester or something. Living was cheap, $350 a month or something. It was all right. He would kid me. He'd say, "So, Melissa, when are you going to get a job?" And I was like, I thought studying was my job. But toward the end of my time there, you know, I always wanted to be a lawyer just like my dad I wanted to be like him. And I thought, well, he smokes and drinks, and he's doing just fine. So I can continue doing what I'm doing, and this is going to work out, you know. I mean, I had no tools. I had no skills for dealing with anything in life besides smoking and drinking. And I was 24 years old, and I was still at college, and I would talk to my dad on the phone a few times a week. I worked for him from the time that I was 14 years old until the time I left for college at 21. So I worked for him on and off. And, you know, I just always wanted to be like him. And I always really identified with him, even though I think I always craved his attention. And when I was about 17 years old and I was working for him, it's when he started, like, his way of, we started doing things like sharing jokes, like dirty jokes, you know. And that was how I felt like I bonded with my dad. Oh, and by the, when I was 16 years old was the time he started smoking weed with me. So, I mean, God, I look at that now and I think, no way in hell. Even if I still smoked weed, there's no way in hell that I would smoke with my children. But, you know, that was what we did. On the ski lifts and the boat and, you know, it was great. But so I was 24 years old and I'm going along at college and just thinking, you know, I want to be just like my dad. Just follow in his footsteps. And I was talking to him on the phone and that's when I started noticing that he was hammered. He was hammered a couple nights a week. Every time I'd talk to him on the phone, he would be like slurring his words and telling me, you know, Melissa, times are tough. And I'm like, I don't really know what that means, but can I help? You know, should I come home? Do you want me to work for you? What's going on? Like, he didn't have any money and his business was failing and he was just loaded every time I talked to him. And, you know, I didn't know, but I got depressed during that time too, I think just because I could hear it in his voice. And then he committed suicide. I bet, I'll never know, but I am, you know, almost certain that he was probably drunk when he did it. I mean, I can't imagine how else do you go out on a boat and, you know, shoot yourself. Like, it just, I don't know. But, you know, so in my mind, I do believe that he died of this disease. I do, you know, I believe he had severe depression, and I believe that this is how he medicated himself. So when that happened, of course, I didn't know what to make of it at all. I just knew I needed to get the hell out of Humboldt and get closer to my mom and my sister. So I moved. I graduated. I made up my own liberal studies major. It was communication of environmental issues. I did 3/4 of the environmental science degree. I got a journalism minor and a Spanish minor and moved to San Francisco. Actually, I moved to Santa Clara, but during the time, I had a boyfriend, but you know what? I couldn't have a real relationship with somebody because I'm an alcoholic, and I don't form relationships with people. I have to keep you at arm's length. I can't really let you know what's really going on inside. You know, if you really knew, first of all, you wouldn't like me, because you wouldn't, you know, and you would never understand. And so no matter how much this guy wanted to love me, I was like, I just couldn't be there. I couldn't do it. And he's an awesome guy. We're still friends. But I just couldn't do it. But I moved there with him. And then, you know, wherever I go, there I am. So I ended up, you know, I worked in a restaurant. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever worked in a restaurant. There's a lot of drugs and alcohol in restaurants. And, you know, I found my people. And I got into all kinds of stuff. And I got took some free something or other from somebody that I probably shouldn't have taken because it wasn't really free. And when they came looking for it, it was, you know, kind of scary. But, you know, after that is when I moved to San Francisco. And I think what happened was, you know, I never dealt with my dad's death, really. I just drank and used because that was how I knew how to deal with it. And so when I got to San Francisco, what I did is I just met up with my next boyfriend who was a professional alcoholic. And it was there that, you know, it just took it to the whole next level. I mean, he had, you know, access to anything and everything that I wanted. And he taught me, man, there was something about it. Like, he would roll around San Francisco with a tall can of beer in his console right there. And to me, that was just, I mean, I've been a rule follower since birth. And to see him rolling around with this open can of beer in his console was equally, like, scary and thrilling. You know, it was just like, you know, that whole bad boy thing. Like, I kind of liked it. So I started doing it too. And then he had these little, I mean, right? So, I mean, he's driving. What's so bad's going to happen to me? So he would, so, and we would get these, what did he call them? I can't remember. Little shots. Well, yeah, yeah, but no, he had another word for them. I can't remember what, but yeah, just like little guys or something like that. I don't remember. So every time we'd stop at the liquor store, I swear to God, it seemed like we stopped at every single liquor store as we went down the road. Wherever we were going, we'd get a tall can and a little guy, and we'd shoot our little shots and then get in the car and drink our beers as we drove down the road. But he also had a penchant for parking in bus stops and other, like, double parking places. And I would just be like, he'd be like, get in the passenger seat in case we have to move the car. I was like, hell no, I'm loaded. I am not sitting in that passenger seat. Get in the driver's seat in case we have to move. No way. No way. So he didn't like that about me. But because I was not going to drive that car all loaded. Nope. Even then it was like, you know, I didn't want to drink and drive. So I stopped driving because I wasn't going to stop drinking, you know. That was not an option. So that's what I did in San Francisco. And I guess you'd say that after that is when I pulled my first geographic, because there was something about it. I was like, I cannot keep doing this. Like, I just knew something was starting to be wrong. I knew something wasn't right. And, you know, the drugs that he had were the ones that made me want him all day, 24/7, and I just could not. I couldn't work like that. I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do anything. So all I knew how to do was leave, and so that's what I did. So I came down here to go to grad school, and but of course, I followed myself. I found my people. I continued doing what I was doing. You know, I made it through grad school, no arrests. No failures. I did what I needed to do. Took out way too many loans, though, because I didn't want to work. You know, it was just like too much to do everything. So I made it. And by, I don't know how, I passed my licensing exam. And then I went out there, and I just, you know, I think I should have known that there was a problem when, in order to pass my exam, I had to quit drinking during the week, because it took me more than one try. And I had to quit drinking during the week, and on the weekends, though, I would still drink. But during the week, I wouldn't drink, and I could not sleep. I could not sleep at all. So I put on the Grateful Dead and, like, just try to sleep through the week. And, you know, maybe then I probably should have realized that there was something very wrong, but I didn't, because, like Travis said, alcohol was my solution. It was not my problem. It was my solution. And for the first 5 years of my career, I drank. And, you know, I didn't go to work drunk. I didn't drink at lunch. I didn't drink in the morning. Even on the weekends. So as far as I was concerned, there was no problem, really. You know, 5 o'clock until 11 o'clock when I passed out, those were my drinking hours. I think that the fact that I did smoke pot kept me from drinking more, honestly, because once I smoked, I didn't drink anymore. I'd still pass out. But, you know, during that time, it was just getting worse and worse. Like, that was the time when I was drinking shots of booze. My routine was to drink shots of booze before I ate dinner or made dinner. Then I make dinner for myself nice and loaded. And then I would have wine with dinner. And then, you know, my bong hits after that. And then walk my dogs and then pass out. But those shots before dinner, like, I would always, you know, the first one was awesome, right? It was awesome. Second one, yeah, it was all right. It wasn't that great. Third one was just pure maintenance at that point. And then sometimes I would have that fourth one. I think it was the fifth one that I would have this war within myself. Don't do it. Don't do it. You know you're going to puke later. Don't do it. I'd be like, ah, no, it'll be different this time. Or no, it'll be all right. I don't care, you know. And then, you know, I'd do it and I'd puke later. But that's when the war within myself began. That was the first time that I wanted to not drink and I couldn't. but I didn't recognize it like that at the time. And so I do that, and I didn't realize, I realized later, that's when I started blacking out. So I would, after dinner, I would walk my dogs. And I would walk my dogs, I lived in Ocean Beach at the time, and I would walk my dogs from, I lived at Ebers and, I can't even remember the name, Muir. No, yeah, it was Muir. It was like Muir and Ebers. And I would walk my dogs from, you know, all the way down and then down Newport Avenue and then all the way back around and smoke cigarettes and talk on the phone or whatever I was doing. And sometimes I'd be out for a long time. And I remember one night, and how I figured it out, I really don't know, but I just remember, like, it was late, and I looked at my dogs, and I was like, and I had been out for at least a couple hours, and I looked at my dogs, and I was like, have I taken my dogs for a walk yet tonight? And somehow it clicked that I've been walking around Newport, you know, down around Ocean Beach in a blackout for 2 hours. And I'm sure that I had done that, you know, I did that a few times. And still I'm like, well, you know, whatever, like, you know, stuff was starting to fall apart, like, you know, having to pull my car over, like, driving home from a meeting for work and having to, like, pull over and take a nap in the back of my car because I was so hungover. You know, stuff like that started to happen. Like, it started to become clear that this was not probably what I needed to be doing. But it never occurred to me. Well, I can't say it never occurred to me not to drink. I just thought I needed to learn how to drink better or differently, right? Like, the whole, part of the book that we read in the beginning here, I tried all the different ways. You know, I tried drinking natural wines, I tried brandy, I tried vodka, I really liked vodka. I tried, you know, all that stuff. I tried all the different combinations to make it work. And I just remember, you know, I remember toward the end of my drinking, like, just looking around and being like, I was 33 at the time, and I always wanted to have kids, and I just looked around, I'm like, where are my children? Where are my kids? Where's my husband? Where's the rest of my life? Like, this is not cool. Like, all I got is my dogs and Jose Cuervo. Like, there's got to be a better, this is not what I bargained for, or this is not what I was hoping for. And something happened. So I had these drinking buddies. I mean, they were friends, and I still am friends with some of them. But there was this group of older dudes that I met at the dog park, and they would always go down to Shades in Ocean Beach and drink and eat and do their thing. And I just hooked up with them. And so every day after work, I would come home. Like, when I didn't do the other ritual I was telling you guys about, I would come home, I would saddle up the dogs, and down we would go to Shades. And my friends renamed the Dirty Martini the Dirty Melissa in my honor. And so they would, you know, order one or two for me on the happy hour thing. I mean, and these were big drinks, too. And we would drink those, tell stories, smoke cigarettes, and have a good time, watch the sunset over Ocean Beach. I mean, like, really, what could be better? My dogs are there. It was awesome. Until one of my friends, word got around in our little group that our friend, he had liver problems from drinking. And so one of our other friends said, don't buy him drinks. And it was like, that just felt so weird. But at the same time, here my friend is, and he's got liver problems, but don't buy him a drink. So he just stopped hanging out with us. You know, he goes someplace else to drink. You guys are going to give me a rough time. He just went someplace else to drink. Well, one night he keeled over in an alley in Ocean Beach, and we found out that, you know, he went to the hospital. You know, he had cirrhosis really bad. He was 43. He was only 10 years older than me at the time, 1 year older than I am, 1 year younger than I am now, and he was dying. And we went to the hospital to visit him, and he was just blown up like a yellow water balloon. And he had, you know, tubes in his veins. And he says to us, look, you guys, I haven't had a drink in 3 days. was like, dude, you're going to die. And he did. 3 days later, he died. And that was, you know, how that was my wake-up call. I was like, oh, shoot. That is going to be me if I keep doing what I'm doing. Somehow I just knew it. I just knew looking at him, that's going to be me. And so I decided to moderate. I said, all right, 2 days on, 3 days off, 2 days on, 3 days off, whatever. I'm just not going to drink every day. And oh, my God, was it hard. It not only was it hard, it was impossible. It was absolutely impossible. I wake up in the morning, I am not going to drink today. Not going to drink today. By 3 p.m., I'm like, man, I want to drink. And nope, not going to drink today. Nope, not going to do it. Not going to do it. And man, that went on for 2.5 years. You know, I did the marijuana maintenance program. I did just filling my time with other things, taking my dogs to the dog park, just anything I could. I kept a journal, and I still have that journal. And it was like during those 2.5 years, I discovered the phenomenon of craving. I used the word craving in my journal entries. I'm like, I didn't drink today, but man, the cravings were strong. It was like I just, you know, and I just, there was things I remember so vividly, like one night just doing my dishes. I am not going to drink today. I am not going to drink today. I am not going to drink today. I just put that drink, I'm like, fuck it. Put that dish down, and I was out the door to the liquor store. I mean, it was just, you know, and I knew, you know, right then, alcohol had control over me. And I knew I was screwed, or I thought I was screwed. But I didn't know what to do. You know, I run my own business. I had no health insurance. Well, I don't know if I had health insurance at the time, but I knew that I couldn't take a month off to go to rehab. Wasn't going to pay 10 to 30 grand to go to rehab. Just, that was not in the cards. And you know, I feel like that's where God or my higher power, whatever you want to call it, whatever you guys want to call it. I choose to call it God these days, but you know, whatever. God is not, I'm grateful that when I got here, they didn't tell me I had to believe in a certain God, because I never have. I grew up without a God. I never thought I needed one. But now this energy that surrounds me, this flow of life that I couldn't control if I ever wanted to, that's what I call God. So this God put a couple of people in my life at just the right time. A landlord. I was looking for a new place to live in Ocean Beach, and I met this guy, and who knows why? I have no idea, but during our conversation, he told me he'd been clean from opiates for 12 years, and I was like, you know what? I think I have a drinking problem. Wait, who said that? You know, it was like, when did I, you know, it was like, okay. And he said, well, if you ever want to go to a meeting, let me know, and I'll take you. And he did take me to a meeting, and I saw a lot of people who looked like you. It was actually in Coronado, so I have to say they were a little bit older. It was an older crowd, and these people were sitting there saying they hadn't had a drink in 20 years, and my God, they looked so happy. And I was like, 20 years? Like, that was insane. How do you do that? Why do you do that? Like, I just really wanted to, you know, I just wanted to, I guess, drink like a lady or whatever. I just didn't want to be doing what I was doing anymore. And it made an impression. And then my best friend from high school, who I did every drug under the sun with, who I drank with, and she had gone toward opiates. Thank God I didn't. Thank God I never got into opiates or pills, because they don't have any calories. I totally would have done that. I would have done the heck out of those, you know? I counted the calories of my vodka and my wine every night as I walked. I was like, so I had 3 shots of vodka, 60 calories each, and then 2 glasses of wine. I mean, I can obsess. Believe me, I can obsess. And but my friend contacted me on Facebook, and she was like, do you want to be in my wedding? I'm like, you're getting married? Like, I was shocked she was still alive, honestly. And she was like, yeah. And she said, she told me she'd been sober for 2 years. So I was like, whoa, really? How? And she told me about AA. And, oh, my God, I just started crying. And she's like, why are you crying? And I'm like, because you gave me hope. Like, seriously, somebody who, you know, where she was at and just the things that she described, it just gave me hope. And so I was in, during that 2.5 years, the most I ever got was 50 days by myself. And I got 50 days, and I was, of course, I was using dating websites because I was trying to find that husband I was talking about. And I was dating this guy, and he said to me, you know, I've never seen you drink. And I was like, thinking to myself, and hopefully you never will. But one night we went to a movie downtown, and it got out relatively early, and he's like, let's go to Whiskey Girl. I was like, fuck, Whiskey Girl, that's a bar. I go, okay. So we went, and he's like, what do you have? And I'm all Jack and Diet. And man, that thing went down so smooth after 50 days. And within the next 20 minutes, I, you know, maybe 40 minutes, I had two more. And then I was like, I need to go home. Like, I need to finish this. You know what I mean? I need to keep doing what I'm doing. I need to drink and I need to smoke and I'll see you later. Like, I was not, but then I asked Bob, he was my landlord. I said, Bob, I want to go to I had already been to that meeting. So I think the next thing that happened was I went to my mother's house for Christmas, and I drove up to San Francisco, and I did not know that December 21st was going to be the last time I drank. I didn't know. And I didn't know that December 22nd was going to be the last time I smoked, because you got to smoke weed when you drive up to San Francisco because it's a long drive. And so I didn't know that those were going to be the days. But December 23, I was like, you know, I'm going to do one of my little 10-day dry outs up here, because I was used to them by then. I said, I'm going to do one of my 10-day dry outs and just see what happens. And I was up there, and as I sat there twiddling my thumbs, I'm like, I wonder if they got AA around here. And I looked it up online, Marin AA, and there was one right around the corner in like a couple hours. And I walked over there, and I sat down, and they gave me How It Works to read. And I was like, it was on. That was it. And I was there for, I think I was there for a good 10 days. I went to a meeting every single day, cried my eyes out. Lots of people gave me their telephone numbers. And it was just, I just knew I was home because, like, you people are they say we're people who wouldn't mix. I think that I think that has a little bit more to do with, like, maybe age and, like, where we are geographically, because otherwise you people are totally people I would have mixed with. I would have partied with all of you, you know what I mean? Because you guys, you drank like I did, you know? I think we would have mixed just fine, and I'm sure you guys had all the stuff I wanted, and I, you know. But I've just felt like I was home from day one when I got in here, when I finally turned myself over to it. And then, you know, I got excited. They're like, any newcomers? Like, you know, because I wanted to tell everybody how I felt at the time. I had a lot of talking to do because I'd been pushing stuff down. And, you know, so they told me, when you get back to San Diego, make sure you know where you're going for the next week. Make sure you write a list of where you're going so you can keep this going. And so I did. I wrote down a bunch of meetings, and I worked downtown, so I went to this noontime meeting. And I'll tell you, this lady walked in the door, and I was like, I didn't even know that I was supposed to be looking for what I wanted, you know, somebody who had what I wanted, I should say. I just knew that this lady had it going on, and she just looked like everything, like she looked natural, she looked confident, she looked just put together and smart, and like she felt comfortable in her own skin. And I was just like, you know, and when they asked for announcements at the end, I said, I need a sponsor. And I was lucky that two people gave me their numbers, and she was one of them. And I walked out with her, and because we were walking the same way, and she just pulled out her coin and showed it to me. It said, I think it was 24 at the time, 24 or 25. And I looked at it, and I was like, does that say, you know, 25? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, does that mean you've been sober for 25 years? She's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, my God. And she goes, you know, you never have to drink again. I said, I would really like that. And, you know, she's my sponsor. She's still my sponsor. You know, and she told me when I finished the steps, she you know, kicked me out of the nest and said, you need to go start sponsoring people because that's what we do here. And I do, even though, I mean, I can't even tell you guys. I've got a minute. My life is so full now. Like, my career is just, I mean, just everything in my life has just blossomed. I got my kids. I don't have the husband, but that's okay. We had the AA romance, and we're still really good friends. And we have these gorgeous, gorgeous children. And, you know, that's great. My career is great. I have this great group of friends. I never used to have friends. I had, like, drinking buddies. I have people who care about me. I care about them. You know, I just, the life that AA has given me you know, I don't know about this whole deserving thing, whatever. All I know is that the life that AA has given me is something that I never had before. Another thing Travis said, I didn't have a life before. I mean, what it was like before I got here was, you know, and like I said, in the beginning it was fun. By the time I got here, it was friggin' miserable. But along the way, you know, what I lost was me, was inside of me. You know, I didn't have anything to lose as far as kids, home. I had a car, managed to keep the car. But, like, what I lost was me. I came here with a giant hole in my soul and that I was trying to fill up. And I've filled it up now. I've filled it up with God and with you guys. And I'll just say, the steps, you have to work the steps. You just have to. That's what changes you from the inside out. That's where you get inside yourself and see why it is that you drink the way you do, why you feel the way you do, why you put yourself in the situations that you put yourself in, and you learn how not to do that anymore. And you actually start to take, oh, those are the traditions, you actually start to take pride. You actually start to take pride in how you conduct yourself. And when you don't, you know that something is wrong and you need to go fix it. And you get used to fixing it, and it's not so hard anymore, and you just keep it going. And thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.